Michael Easter is a leading voice on how humans can integrate modern science and evolutionary wisdom for improved health, meaning, and performance in life and at work. Michael's investigations have taken him to ancient monasteries in Bhutan, U.S. Special Forces training grounds, high-tech genetic labs in Iceland, and some of the world's most remote wilderness areas. I'm Greg Bidet, listening to an ad-free episode of the Portland Podcast. Today's guest is Michael Easter. He speaks with us today, fresh from his appearance on the Joe Rogan Podcast. He is promoting his brand new book, The Comfort Crisis, Embrace Discomfort to Create Your Wild, Healthy, Happy Self. Here's Michael Easter.
That must have been a thrill to be on the Joe Rogan Podcast. You must have thought that maybe you had a chance when you could talk about the elk that you shot in Nevada.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting going into that one. And he's a good guy. I had a lot of fun talking to him, so it was definitely fun.
He knows a person, a specialist in almost everything that you discuss, so I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. He's super smart, and I think that people maybe don't expect that because he's the UFC guy. You know, he even jokes, he's like, you know, I was the host for Fear Factor, you know? But he's one of those people who's super sharp, and he knows a little bit about everything. So he can just talk to anyone, which explains the success of the show. So.
Yes. No, it's very true. And I'd like to touch on your book, The Comfort Crisis. Just finished it. And
awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot there to cover. I'll try to do my best in 20 minutes. You flew on a bush plane to Alaska, a Campbell soup cans with wings, as you describe it. Very funny.
Yes, it was. It did indeed feel like that at times. It's a little sketchy. I had my heart rate was surely up getting into that thing. But hey, I'm here. I survived it. We got a book out of it. So we're good.
The group that you left with on your adventure, you mentioned in the book that somehow you were able to draft some fake media badges. I didn't know there was a cheap rate when you were traveling as a media rep overseas or to Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah, I did not know that either. So I had to take we joke, it's like the more remote that you're going to be, your final destination is, the more planes you have to take, and you go from big, huge, you know, jumbo jet to smaller jet to, you know, regional jet down to the Campbell soup can with wings. But so I met up with the guys I was hunting with in Seattle. We had a layover to take the flight up to Anchorage. And yeah, he pulls out this fake media badge and he goes, "Hey, how does this look? You're a member of the media." I'm like, "Yeah, this looks great. But like, why?" He's like, "Oh, you can get a media rate. We saved like $900. I was like,
"That's
oh my God.
Tip. That's a good travel tip right there." And media badges are usually just shit. They are just shit. So it sounded like he knew what he was doing. Rediscovering boredom. You managed to memorize energy bar ingredients and wrappers and tags of outdoor gear while you're out there in the bush, so to speak.
Yes, I did. So, I mean, this is so different from how we live at home, right? It's when we're home, we're often on our cell phones, or we have the TV on constantly, or we're at a computer, or we're listening to a podcast, or we're doing X, Y, and Z all the time.
We have things at the same time.
Exactly.
Like you're playing
a
video game, listening to a podcast, scanning through Instagram. It's insane.
Yes, exactly. So we have so many easy ways to distract ourselves from boredom now, but boredom, as we evolved, it was this cue. This uncomfortable cue that basically told us that whatever we were doing, it wasn't a good return on our time invested. So like back in our past, this would compel us to, you know, go hunt for a different animal because this hunt we're on right now is going south. Or like we've spent enough time picking berries. We're bored of it now. Let's go do something else that's going to help us survive. But now we have this easy way to kill it, right? Which is the cell phones, all the screens. We spend like 11 hours a day engaging with digital media. But up there, all of a sudden, it's like my cell phone is a useless, it's essentially a camera only, right? Because there's no service within miles and miles. So all of a sudden, I found myself in this state that I hadn't experienced really since, you know, I started buying iPhones in 2007 or whenever it came out. And
the death of boredom.
Yes, boredom is indeed dead now. And by getting up there and sort of going through that boredom, you realize, this is actually interesting. You like leave, you have more time for your mind to wander and this extended time, you know? And there's a lot of research that says going through boredom can help improve your creativity because nowadays when you look at your phone, you're just looking at the same stuff that everyone else is creating and kind of thinking on the same wavelength. Whereas if you have these times to go inward and just think and process information and figure stuff out, you're going to get a pretty big creativity boost. So there's a lot of, and it also just gives your brain a rest, having periods of sort of mental downtime are associated with less anxiety, less depression, all that kind of stuff. I mean, everyone's burned out today. And like, really the reason is because all we do is answer email and watch TV and Netflix and Instagram all day. Yeah, so,
right. I think you use the phrase, the magic of boredom. I'm pretty sure there's going to be a book with that in the title. I just think there's a book coming out about boredom. I think we need this.
Yeah, well, hopefully I covered enough in my own book that people will just buy my book because, you know, I got to make a living. But yeah, if you want more than like 5,000 words on boredom, you might need another book.
It's a very interesting passage in the book where you talk about speaking with a guru, Bhutanese guru. All the Bhutanese own their own houses. If that's not a reason to move there, I don't know what. But you need to be escorted wherever you go in Bhutan. You can't just move there. They have a very interesting relationship with death. I thought that was a very interesting passage in the book. Also, the shift from chapter 17 to 18, I think, was the highlight for me. I felt the tension. You're talking about impermanence, death, with the guru, and then you jump to taking a life. That was very gripping. And you touch on that with Joe Rogan too. That, again, I also thought in the Joe Rogan podcast, that was the most interesting and powerful moment when you both described taking the life of an animal.
Right. Well, I'm glad you like that. You know, it's interesting because my background is, I wasn't a hunter going into this. And so I spend more than a month up in the Arctic and I'm with a guy who is a good hunter. And initially I hadn't really even planned on hunting. Cause I had reservations about it. You know, I eat meat, 95% of Americans do. So I could see that there's kind of something weird, between like
normal.
Not being willing. Yeah. And it is normal. But I had reservations and, you know, we get up there and I decide I'm going to hunt and I do hunt, you know, I end up killing this caribou. And initially right after the caribou went down, I was a mess. And I was like, why would I ever do this? Like, there's no coming back from this. I can't change this. Like, I am permanently scarred and I've done something wrong. And then when we start field dressing it, you start to see that, oh, this is meat. And this is the same type of meat that I eat every single day. And yet never before have I had these emotional reservations and felt, you know, really bent out of shape and regretful about all the other meat that I eat. So like, why do I feel that way? And I think it's because as a society, we've really, you know, death is the most uncomfortable thought. We've removed ourselves from the life cycle. You know, you look at our food system, slaughterhouses are very secretive. Yeah. Our meat is, we buy our meat. No one knows what is in they. We don't know where they are. We just know that we don't really want to see them. And there's a lot of
processing.
Laws in place.
Processing yeah. center. Yeah. That's what they call it. It's not even a slaughterhouse anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And then when we get that meat at the grocery store, you know, it doesn't really appear. There's no signs that it really came from an animal. It's kind of perfectly packaged and shiny. And so we're really removed from it. And also in our funeral system, you know, we don't, you know, a person is
sanitized.
Yeah. The way they, you know, after someone dies, we make them look as alive as possible. And then we, you know, we have a viewing that's a short amount of time and then they're kind of gone. And then we're told to take our mind off it. But in Bhutan, it's very different. Part of their sort of national curriculum is they think about death often and death is sort of woven into their culture.
A cliff. Death is a cliff.
Yes, exactly. They think about it in terms of like, look, death is a cliff and we know we're all walking towards that cliff. So you can either pretend the cliff isn't there or you can be like, oh, a cliff is coming. And if you do that, it's going to change your behavior because all of a sudden you're going to be like, oh, there's an end to this. And people tend to start to behave in a way that they know is going to be more meaning, add more meaning to their life. They, you know, they tend to be happier because they tend to make decisions that cut out a lot of the noise that we get hung up on in everyday life. You know, it's like, you don't get flipped out if someone, you know, cut you off in traffic because you're just like, why am I wasting my mental energy on this random person? You know what I mean? You start to just have these like moments where you can see like, I got one life in theory. Right. Why would I get bent out of shape about all this stuff that I used to? Like, I'm going to focus on the things that are really going to, that I know are going to make me happy. And it seems to move the dial. So Bhutan is, by economic measures, it's one of the least developed nations on earth. It's like, I think 160 something out of 180. And yet in terms of happiness, they're in the top 20.
No so street lights, US, no street lights in one of the cities.
Yeah, no stoplights. So, and that's the capital city. I mean, there's not even a stoplight in the entire country. Really, you know, underdeveloped, and yet they're all super happy because they've.
Oh, good! I hate stopping.
Yeah, exactly. but it's interesting, and you know, because here in the U.S. we put so much value on economic metrics, you know, and they've really been like, well, the whole point of making any money is so you can be happy. So why don't we just focus on what's going to make people happy and then just chase that instead of being like, well, in theory, this dollar value can help you buy happiness, where we know from research that yes, a certain amount of money, once you have your basic, you know, health and safety accounted for and you have very basic needs, that will make you happy. But like earning $1 million beyond that isn't going to do a huge amount. It's not going to do as much as you would think. So
you killed an injured animal and the animal was already injured. So you hunted ethically, which I thought was interesting reading. And the way you described taking the life, you describe it in the book, but I thought it was a lot more powerful on when you were discussing it with Joe. I think it's because you had that, you know, face to face with Joe. He described it as indescribable. You described it as depression and feeling alive. I thought that was very powerful. That was a very powerful moment.
Yeah, and I think that's what it was. It's like, it's one of those things like, hey, I'm a trained science journalist. I read thousands of studies. I read like so much research for this book. And that feeling is not something that you can really measure at all. But I do think that there's something about humans having evolved in the context of hunting and gathering where, you know, that means something to us still, and we're removed from that. And I'm not suggesting that everyone should hunt. I'm just saying that when I put myself in that position, it was a feeling like I'd never felt before. And like I said, this like real dichotomy of feeling both alive and totally depressed, which was just very, very powerful. And it changed me, you know, it's changed my behavior since. Like, as I talked about on the podcast, I said, you know, when someone takes up hunting, you would think, oh, they probably eat more meat. Like the complete opposite has been true, because I've been a lot more conscious of the meat I eat and where it comes from. And I realized that, you know, when we're talking about meat and, you know, conventional or, you know, meat raised in a big processing facility, like, you know, you put it versus like grass fed. Like, I realized that you have to have a certain level of income to eat something like grass-fed, all the Whole Foods upsells, right? But at the same time, it's like, if you have those means, I think that that could be potentially worthwhile. I think that just eating less meat in general, because a lot of people eat a lot of meat, Americans especially. I mean, we eat something like 200 pounds a person. It's a lot of meat. And there's definitely some environmental concerns around that, but I think mainly ethically. So I think like if someone isn't, I think everyone could probably eat less meat if they wanted to. If you're in a position to buy meat that perhaps the animal's maybe taken better care of, I think that's a smart choice. Again, it's like you have to be in that economic position, but you also have to be in an economic position to donate to charity, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these other things that you might have to, sometimes you need to have some money to do good. And if you don't have money, that's totally fine that you're not, you know.
Thank you for turning me on to Trevor Cashy. I'm going to be following him very closely in the future. He has a podcast. He's a diet prodigy, a bit eccentric too, which I kind of like. But you also talk about, you know, measuring your food in the book. Apparently you were taking a lot more peanut butter than you thought.
Yeah.
measuring your food, very important. And I think he's very pragmatic, Cashy.
And you touched on his you know, him working, making meth with the Hell's Angels. Interesting character. And I have to thank you for turning me on to his work, because he's got this nutrition website. Fascinating man.
He's a trip. He's become one of my best friends over time. And yes, very,
really?
Very far out, but unbelievably intelligent. I mean, he's changed my thinking on everything from nutrition to just life in general, probably more than anyone I know. And every conversation with him is like one of those where you leave so frustrated, but you leave frustrated because you're like, man, he just like blew up a whole lot of what I thought I knew, you know?
Right.
But in terms of his approach to food, yeah, it's like, here's the deal. If you look at all the data, it's like people don't really know how much they eat. We, you know, we are programmed as human beings because we evolved in this like uncomfortable landscape where there was never enough food. We developed these reward mechanisms that reward us for overeating. It always made sense through all of time to eat more food than we needed rather than less. But then our environment flipped about 100 years ago, and all of a sudden food is everywhere. It's more calorie dense than it's ever been. And it's also cheaper, and it also takes zero effort to get, unless you consider going through a drive-through effort or walking through a grocery store, which is great because that's why we're, you know, we have 8 billion people. Like, that's what we need to do to feed all these people. But at the same time, we have so much of it, and we have these drives that tell us to eat a lot of it, and it's calorie dense, that you can see the results. You know, we're, as a country, I think we're, more than 70% of us are either overweight or
headed
obese.
To 80% in just 20 years, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, headed into the 80s.
Oh, man.
And the reality is, yeah, it's like people don't really realize how much they eat every day. And so his idea of, you know, I want you to learn, we're going to run a scientific experiment. Like, that is his background. He is a hardcore scientist. So he has you, for at least the first couple of weeks, you're going to weigh everything you eat, and you're going to put it in a calorie tracker, and you're going to learn something. So for me, I thought I was eating pretty healthy. And like, my background is I worked at Men's Health magazine for about a decade, and I still do. You'd think that I would know this. And then I weigh peanut butter the first time, and I'm eating like my lunch that I thought was like 500 calories. It's like smart and intelligent, healthy choice.
Really? It's a funny passage.
Yeah, and it was like 1,000 calories. And it's like, now extrapolate that across every single day, across the year. It's like, well, no, Matt, no wonder Americans are overweight. It's like there's so much food, and we just eat what we think is a serving, but we really have no clue what a serving is. So that sort of knowledge, I think, can help people frame exactly, well, how much do I really need? And then also, you know, the flip side of that is that he helps people realize why they're eating. Because, you know, if you look at all these crazy different diets that we have out there today, some are crazy, some are not so crazy. Well, they all work if you follow them. So then the question is like, well, why can't you follow them? You know, most diets, I think it's something like in the 90% of people who start a given diet, lose weight, will gain that weight back, because at about week 5, people tend to fall off because things start to happen with their hunger. They get hungry, basically, and it starts to get boring, and it sucks. So we need to figure out this why question. It's like, why can't you stay on that? And oftentimes it comes down to hunger. So figuring out ways to manage your hunger is key. And also figuring out, again, how much you're actually eating is helpful as well. And the book gets into like the techniques and tactics that he uses. So
Yes, it does. And you talk a lot about rucking too, farm boy strength. And after your adventures in Alaska, your wife mentioned that you were hard to rattle. I thought that was interesting. You're just a nicer dude, less of an asshole.
Yeah, I think I was less of an asshole. And I think it's actually stuck around a little bit. Like, look, here's the deal. Is like, we as a society, especially if you have any sort of economic means, you know, this book is really, I realize that there are uncomfortable people in the world. And so this book is like offering, it's geared to Americans, and it's offering up a lot of solutions that are low cost to a lot of the like problems we have now that are not real problems, you know, like think of them as first world problems. So by going into Alaska and like having really nothing, being hungry, everything takes effort. You know, getting from point A to point B is like the craziest workout you've ever done. Sleeping on the ground, being freezing cold the whole time, no running water. Once you get back into an environment we live in now.
Well, the epilogue of the book, you talk about how filthy you were, just absolutely, you were pure filth.
Oh yeah, 30 days, no showers. I mean, I was completely disgusting. Totally. Yeah, it was terrible. But once you get back into like these amazing environments we live in now that have like everything you could ever want, hot running water, a fridge full of food, it's always 72 degrees in every building. It's like, you really appreciate that once you've been away from that for 30 days. Whereas we just don't have these moments. We get sucked into, and there's a good psychological reason for this. I talked to a researcher at Harvard who basically told me that like we adapt to our circumstances and we kind of have blinders on and we can't see how good we have it now relative to the grand scheme of time and space and human experience. So by sort of getting out of that environment we live in now and coming back to it, you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. How have I ever complained or had a first world problem in my life? This is just so great. And that gives you a lot of perspective. And to your point, makes you less of an asshole because I'm not going to complain that the waiter didn't fill up my glass as fast as I would have,
right?
Glass of water as fast as I would like to have. Exactly. I'm like going into the first like couple of weeks, I would just go into a bathroom and turn on hot water and I'd just have this massive grin on my face. It's like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this, you know? So it just gives you a lot more perspective on your life and how you're living it. And it helps you realize that a lot of the shit that we complain about now are not real problems. Again, I realize that there are real problems in the world that we need to fix, and people can have big problems in your life. But so much of what we complain about today is just stuff that, like, in the grand scheme of time and human experience, is just, I mean, frankly, it's a lot of bullshit, you know?
I remember reading Gone with the Wind about the struggle in that book. This is a long time ago. You mentioned Donnie held a caribou's heart at one point like he was Hamlet. Also hilarious.
Yep, he did. And then I had to carry that barefisted across the tundra back to camp. And we ate it later in the night. I mean, it's, you know, when you're that hungry and like in terms of, you know, going back to meat and animals, it's like there's so much of the animal that we don't eat because we're not used to it. And really, every piece of meat on an animal is edible and it's really healthy. Like the heart has a lot of really great nutrients along with like the liver. And so even just experimenting with that was totally different than today because we've sort of made everything palatable and comfortable and approachable and that sort of thing.
You know, so many books you read, I read a lot of nonfiction. So many of them focus on inspiring you to action. This is a very actionable book. I'm not so much as inspired, but I just want to experience life more. And I think that's probably the goal of this book. I want to get out of comfort, be uncomfortable. And that's my takeaway.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you got that message. And I think it is, you know, I go back to, we're so comfortable now that by sort of getting out of our comfort zone in this variety of ways that I lay out in the book, you're going to have these health benefits. That's measurable. You know, you're probably going to lose some weight if you follow the hunger thing and you're overweight.
It's actionable. You're gonna get fitter. This book is very actionable.
Actionable. But like, more importantly, you're just going to be like, man, I really appreciate life. I feel like I'm living. And like at the end of your life, that's the shit you're going to remember. You're not going to remember, oh, I lost 5 pounds or 10 pounds or like, oh, my bench press went up. Like that stuff will happen. But really, like, I'm hoping that people just go and just like, man, live hardcore. You know what I mean? It's like, just experience life.
Fill the scrapbook.
Yeah. Amen.
Joe Rogan podcast, you're a superstar now. You must be thrilled to be just riding the wave of that. That must be really thrilling being on the biggest show in the world.
It was super cool. I mean, the whole point of that, though, is that then you get this outreach from people who pick up the book and they're like, holy shit, I did this thing and like I'm better now. Or like, man, this really made me rethink how I'm living life. Like the outpouring on that has been what's really cool. I mean, going on Rogan the whole point is that, like, get your message out. And if your message is helping people, then hell yeah, it's awesome.
So few books make it to this level. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Michael. Much
appreciated. Hey, thank you. It was Cheers. Great to talk.
And thank you for listening to the Portland Podcast. I'm your host, Gregory Day. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can reach me at greg@pdxpodcast.com. We'll be back with a brand new episode very shortly. See you then.